Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and welcome to Monday, October 23. Hope your weekend was good. Hope you got some rest. Nice to be back, and it's a happy Monday. Let's start with a little passage from Galatians. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks they are something when they are not, they deceive themselves. Each one should test their own actions. Then they can take pride in themselves alone without comparing themselves to someone else, for each one should carry their own load. Nevertheless, the one who receives instruction in the word should share all good things with their instructor. Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Whoever sows to please their flesh from the flesh will reap destruction. Whoever sows to please the Spirit from the Spirit will reap eternal life. Let us not become weary in doing good. For at the proper time, we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says the president is getting a lot more done than he's given credit for. The Kentucky Republican tells CNN State of the Union that President Trump's appointments are changing the country with optimism about the economy picking up. McConnell says the president should give himself a little more credit for the changes he's bringing about that are turning the country in a different direction. Sentencing today begins for Army deserter Bo Bergdahl in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Bergdahl pled guilty without any deal with the Army to limit his potential sentence. I have a feeling he is going to go away for a while. All right, we're going to continue with some of the weekend headlines and updates with my friend Patrick Albanese from prestigious West Des Moines. We'll take a short break. It's 6 minutes after. Good morning. So glad you're with me. Bye-bye. Back in a minute.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could
while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
Welcome to the show. So glad you're with us this morning. I read a 112-year-old woman credits her long life to one of the things she does not do is drink coffee. You call that living? I don't want to live to be 112 if I can't drink coffee. Anyway,
you won't be awake for most of it.
My guest this morning is Patrick Goldman. He's my friend and prestigious cohort from West Des Moines. Good morning, Patrick.
Yes, good morning. 112 years old, no coffee.
Yeah, I don't want to live that long.
That means she was asleep for 14 hours a day. her real age is like 62.
That's true.
She's not 112.
That's true.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Well, as I'm looking out over all the news and all the reporting that goes on, of course, there was such incredible news that the jobless claims were the lowest they've been since 1973. We're not hearing people rave about that.
No, we're not. And, you know, it's because a Republican's president, and not only is a Republican president, but Trump, whether he's a Republican or not, I don't know, but he's president, and you can't report a single piece of good news. It's all trash all the time, and sometimes he makes it easy, but you go, the stock market's at ridiculously high levels.
It's up $5 trillion since Trump took office.
I'll have you know, $172 of that is in my pocket.
Nice.
$172.
You're a savvy investor.
Well, I had that one share of stock.
Went up. Yeah.
Probably should have bought more when the getting was good.
Mm-hmm. But you also were the guy that bought the ant farm that only had one ant in it. You never saw the ant.
I never did see the ant.
No.
It turns out you need more than one.
You got to have a colony. Yeah, you got to have a colony of ants. Otherwise, the ant farm is just a big waste of time and money.
I know. And then that one ant suddenly gets kind of lazy. He's like, sure, I can lift 57 times my own body weight and I can work all day. But why? Why bother?
There's no competition here.
There's no competition and nobody's holding me accountable. So I'm just going to kind of hang out, which I think is me. That's me some days. I go, you know, there's nobody around watching. I'm going to do nothing.
But the media certainly has a way of keeping us distracted so they don't have to report on the good news that's actually going on in our country.
Yes. And sometimes I wonder if, you know, Trump is clever enough to know underneath it all that he can keep them distracted while he does other things. I mean, he is appointing a record number of conservative judges to courts, which will change the landscape of the courts for years to come. It gets no press. It gets nothing. And maybe he likes it that way. Maybe he can just very quietly go about, I think we talked about Scott Pruitt at one point in time, dismantling some of these onerous EPA regulations that have been stifling businesses. And, you know, he ended this war on coal and these economies are booming because of it. And the regulations being rolled back, two for every new one. You see, he's quietly doing that. They don't want to report it. The highest labor participation rate we've had in a few years, and the lowest unemployment in, what did you say, 40 years?
No, 1973.
45. Oh, yeah. I
imagine heard the sport coats we were wearing then.
Members only. No, yeah, those hadn't come out yet.
No, big plaid. Big plaid, big lapels.
Well, not only was it big plaid, big lapels, you could put it in the washing machine in the dryer and it came out wrinkle-free. That was back in the days of Sansa Belt.
It was. I love Sansa Belt. Yeah. Hager slacks. Yeah, those are great.
Yep, they were great. A 4-inch wide elastic band, which kind of mimicked a Santa Claus belt. Oh, gosh, I miss Sansa Belt.
Oh, I miss Sansa Belt, too. They were great. They were great times. All right. Some Harvard professor, Harvard lawyer, has been inundated with questions about the legality and possibilities of somehow, some way, Hillary still becoming president.
And he came up with a way.
Well, it's a legal way. It's a legal way. He says it's highly unlikely, but, you know, just to satisfy all the people that were writing in and asking him questions, how could it happen, he responded.
Now, you say highly unlikely, but now let me just lay out his simple 6-step plan. And then let's see if you eat those words about highly unlikely.
All right. Let's start. Walk me through this.
First, step one, find Trump guilty of collusion with the Russians.
Okay.
That's all you got to do. Now, we've been working on this for well over a year. We've got nothing so far. If you keep digging.
Yeah, we'll keep digging.
Yeah, so that's step one.
Appoint a few more committees.
Yeah, I'll have you know, by the way, that step one is the easiest of the 6 steps.
All right.
Okay.
What is step two?
Step two, then you have to impeach him, which automatically makes Mike Pence the vice president. Okay. So you get a twofer there.
Okay.
Now, they don't like Mike Pence, so you got to go to step three. Pence resigns because he says, well, I would have never got elected if Trump hadn't got elected. And since he colluded with the Russians, technically I colluded with the Russians, so I shall resign.
So he willingly steps aside.
However, there's a small thing that has to happen. He has to make the mistake of stepping aside before appointing a vice president. Okay?
Okay.
If he appoints a vice president, then that person becomes president. But if he just steps aside and says, I can't believe I stepped aside before I got to appoint a vice president, then Paul Ryan, he gets to become the president.
Speaker of the House is always third in line.
Boom. He moves up. Now, he gets to choose a vice president. So he decides to reach across party lines, and he chooses Hillary for vice president. So that's step five.
Okay. I'm with you so far.
Step six. All Paul Ryan has to do from that point on is resign, and Hillary becomes president. Now, the thing – I look at the 6-step program. I say, well, if he's going to be living in la-la land, why didn't he just say find Trump guilty – impeach him, and Pence becomes president, and why doesn't Pence just appoint Hillary vice president, then resign? Wouldn't that eliminate, you know, 4, 5, 5.7, 5.8? Yeah, I think...
I feel like we're watching Dumb and Dumber, and Lloyd Christmas is saying, so you're telling me there's a chance.
There's a yeah, but now in Dumb and Dumber, there actually was a chance because it was one in a million. It's one in a million. Yeah, this is more like, you know, the underpants gnomes who had the plan to steal underpants. Then step two was question mark. Step three was profit. And yeah. Every time we're asked what step two is, they go, we don't know.
We yet. Don't know how that's going to happen, but we just know profit's on the way.
Yeah, if we can figure out step two, we win.
All right.
Yeah, this is, by the way, a Harvard education is going to cost you at least $250,000 to go take a class from this guy. I'm willing to do it for months.
That's just too much. I appreciate the analysis. Six simple steps for Hillary to become president. I love it. Let me take a break. When I come back, more with Patrick Albanese, my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines. Be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. Glad you're joining us this morning. I'm speaking to Patrick Albanese, my friend and colleague from West Des Moines. Patrick, as we were just processing during the break, that insanity formula for Hillary becoming president, I need a break. I need a desperate break. And I need coffee, unlike the 112-year-old lady.
Yeah, the 112. I'm still struggling with that. But yeah,
why would you wanna, I don't think. Why would you want to live to 112 without coffee? I just don't get it.
I don't know. Actually, is coffee good or bad right now?
No, it's good right now.
It's good right now. It's good for you.
Yeah. No, it's not always good, but it's good now.
We've lived long enough where we've seen it run the cycle a couple of times. And I mean, they had we've gone through the margarine thing. Butter good, butter bad. Eggs good, eggs bad.
Bacon good, bacon bad. Well, no, bacon's always bad.
Bacon's always bad. But it tastes so good.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know, 112, I think. Is she she's still around?
Yeah, she just had a birthday.
I'd love to see her try her first cup of coffee at 112. Look at this.
Yeah.
I climb stairs.
Oh, boy. All right, let's talk a little bit about our industry, the entertainment industry, which you and I have been a part of for many, many years. And unlike...
We're on the fringe.
We're on the fringe, the fringe of the fringe.
<All in.
laughs> And unlike most other industries, in the entertainment industry runs on scarcity. The unemployment rate in the U.S. is roughly 4.2% right now.
Right.
But for people who want to go in front of a camera or stand on stage, unemployment is closer to 90%. Always has been and always will be.
Yeah, that's the employment rate. 4.2% is the employment rate.
Right. Right.
It's a, you know, and it, of course, it breeds a playground, shall we say, for people who know how to manipulate others who so desperately want a, you know, a piece of that pie that they'll do almost anything. I've seen it. I've heard it. I've worked in a restaurant that was, you know, catered to the Hollywood crowd. It catered to the TV studios, and the Paramount Studios was right nearby. And it was, I'd see the people fresh off the turnip boat that would come in, you know, from Lansing. And I remember one girl in particular from Lansing, in fact. And I said, "Oh, are you a wannabe?" She says, "I'm a gonna be." And a year later, she was gonna be going back to Lansing. But in the meantime, you know, she would come in on the nights when the industry people would hang out. And the next thing you know, she's out back with some celebrity or producer doing who knows what. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, do you do that stuff in Lansing?
Probably not.
But the longer she was there, the more desperate she became. And unfortunately, there are predators in that town that can see that. And they will take advantage of that, and they never really have to deliver much of anything. You know, it's a sad thing. You know, Hollywood is a bit of a cesspool when Charlie Sheen is the most honest person you ever hear talking.
But the power imbalance in Hollywood is so out of whack, and the people that might have a predatory nature find themselves the happiest when they're in that position of power. In a place surrounded by people who are vulnerable and wanting to become a star or just get a job in media somehow.
Yeah. I mean, with show business, is not only is it a gamble to try and pursue a life there, it also has a small window of opportunity. It tends to be a little bit more harsh on women. They're, you know, considered almost over the hill by the time they hit their mid-30s. And what that means is it doesn't mean that you're not usable, but you kind of move into the character actor category. Because when it comes to the female leads, they want youth. Now, they tend to want youth with the men as well. But, you know, if somebody's still a viable Harrison Ford type, he's going to work. And there aren't as many Meryl Streeps. And so everybody knows this. You know, you don't show up in Hollywood at 25 years old and not know that you have about a five-year window to get this thing started. If you don't get it started, then it becomes – I have a friend who's a manager out there, and he wouldn't even manage people that were already over the age of 30. He says, if you're not already up and running, I can't get you started. Mm. And he said it's not that it's undoable, but it's just – it's the odds are so against us, and everybody knows it. And then unfortunately, they become more desperate because they told everybody back in Lansing, I'm moving to L.A. I'm going to make it big. And they don't want to go back home and, you know, go work at Joe's Brake Shop.
Right. I had a meeting not that many years ago at the Princess in Beverly Hills.
Oh.
That is a swanky place.
Yes.
It's like $1,000 just to walk into the place.
Yeah.
And I saw...
How'd you get in? You know.
And I saw James Gandolfini in there, and he was walking his very small poodle. Inside the hotel, he had it on a leash, and he had these big shorts on and a white T-shirt, which looked like it hadn't been washed in about a month, and he looked like he hadn't showered in about a week. And I thought to myself, it's Tony Soprano, for those of you who may not connect the name, but you might know him as the actor Tony Soprano. And I thought, yeah, in Hollywood, he's still a power player.
Yes. Yes, you years ago, I remember I saw Nick Nolte in a bathrobe at a Denny's, and that just that completely throws you. that's Nick Nolte at a Denny's in a bathrobe, and I believe he's eating a Moons Over My Hammy breakfast. it shattered a whole bunch of illusions all at once for me.
I'm sure.
This is not normal, but for Nick Nolte, evidently it was normal.
Yeah. But let's
talk. He can do that.
Yeah, let's talk about what the actors generally say at award shows, and this is a little bee in your bonnet, which so I'm going to let you talk about it.
Yeah, you mean other than thanking Harvey Weinstein, which won't be happening this year,
right.
Which means the Oscar telecast will be 53 minutes long.
Right.
It'll be right. Very tolerable.
Yeah.
They always get up there and they do the old believe in your dreams. All the kids' movies do that. And I don't want to discourage anybody from believing in their dreams, even though I've been discouraged from believing in mine. But, you know, the reality is one actress per year wins Best Actress. One. And so when you say to the – in Los Angeles alone, there's, you know, minimum, let's say, 10,000 young starlets trying to, you know, make it. If you say to those 10,000, believe in your dreams and you can be here accepting an Academy Award, you say, well, that won't be true for 9,999 of them this year. And if we extend this thing out for 50 years, should all of you live that long and stick with the business, it's still not true for 9,950 of you. And of course, there's a lot more than 10,000 vying for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And they always make it seem like it's just this magic thing, like they actually had some control over it. And the reality is talent is certainly a part of it, but there is luck involved. And one of the reasons why every showbiz person I knew that made it and made some money used to be on the side of, you know, higher taxes, tax the rich, is because I think they assume everybody that has any money got lucky, that they realized that, you know, I'm a talented guy, but there were 500 other guys of a similar level of talent, and I got picked. I got picked because they liked my nose.
Mm-hmm.
And my that simple.
Yeah.
And I think it's not that that's a dirty hidden secret. It's just that it's very hard to show up in a place, you know, you take any other profession and you say you're the top in your craft, you're the top heart doctor, you're the top, you know, you're Joe's break. You're Joe's best break jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to work. you will work. You're a great accountant. You will work. And in Hollywood, it doesn't matter.
Good point. Patrick, thanks so much for your analysis. I always look forward to chatting with you on Monday mornings. I appreciate you very much, my friend. I will talk to you soon. Have a great day.
You too.
Yep. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Good morning. It's half past the hour. See, I saw a picture over the weekend of five presidents with Lady Gaga. That's an odd picture. I have to say, though, that President Carter, he is amazing. I mean, he's 93 years old. He is moving good and looking fantastic and overcoming brain surgery, cancer, and oh my goodness. Anyway, we're going to take another break for news, and then we come back. Dr. Adam Carrington's going to be with us at 20 minutes, too. Be back in a minute.
We're connecting faith and life together.
I mean, it's always a challenge to keep our thoughts on Jesus in the midst of all the distractions that are going on around us. And I find that if I turn to other places on the radio, I can easily start to get my mind thinking on topics that really aren't helpful to my soul. Listening brings me back and makes me a healthier person, emotionally, spiritually, enriches my life and leads to more flourishing along the way.
It's the intersection of faith and life. Faith Radio. We're connecting faith and life together.
Your radio station is a treasure, and it's a shame that there's a lot of other cities that don't have this kind of treasure. The gospel from a different perspective and a different aspect of life and how it applies to all aspects of life. And having it right there on my radio station, right there, perfect.
It's the intersection of faith and life. Faith Radio.
Good morning. It's 24 minutes until the top of the hour. We've got Dr. Adam Carrington already on the studio line. I don't want to keep him waiting too long, but Rebecca, I know we've got one other thing coming up before him. What is
We do. We have a bit from Johnny Moore, who's a professor and author, and has done a lot of research on the question, what am I supposed to do with my life and the search for God's will? And he says the first principle of understanding God's will for your life involves understanding who you are.
So the first point is this. God's will is more about who you are than where you are or what you're doing. It's more about who you are than where you are or what you're doing. Now, every single student that sat in my office at Liberty University, every peer in my age group, I'm 31 years old, every person older than me, every person much older than me, when they start talking about God's will, they are totally transfixed on two questions. Where am I supposed to live and what am I supposed to do? And yet, when you read the Bible and you read what the Bible says about God's will, it says things like this, like Paul wrote to the church at Thessalonica. It says, this is God's will, that you be sanctified. It has nothing to do with your location or your vocation. It has to do with who you are, because you take you with you wherever you are. And so the first principle of God's will has nothing to do with where you live or what you do. It has everything to do with who you are. God's will is more about who you are than where you are or what you're doing.
If you want to hear that full interview with Johnny Moore, go to myfaithradio.com and type in Johnny Moore. We'll take a short break, and then Adam Carrington is next.
One man leading others changed the course of Christian theology. This is Jim Garlow remembering the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther believed that by knowing God's word for oneself, one can discover that he's justified by faith, that grace is available to all. On October the 31st, 1517, the eve of All Saints' Day, Martin Luther walked down the street towards the church. The castle church door functioned as sort of a local newspaper / bulletin board. In today's vernacular, a chat room. With a small mallet, a few nails, he lifted a paper to the church door and nailed it there. Within 3 weeks, his statements of protest, known as the 95 Theses, spread all over Germany, a catalyst for the Protestant Reformation. Sola Scriptura, by Scripture alone, and Sola Christus, by Christ alone, became part of the hallmark of every Protestant group that followed Luther.
Welcome
All right, it's 22 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College is already on our studio line. Adam, good morning.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Good. Promise me you'll never leave me.
I will do my best. I think God's in charge of that, ultimately.
Of course. I just love having you on the show. There's always, I always love your perspective on things, and you put things in their proper place, so thank you for doing that. I want to start this morning with the Fourth Circuit Court in Prince George County. They've got a huge cross that was built in 1925 that was designed to honor World War I veterans, and now it's at risk of being taken down, or what's going on with that?
Sure. It's putting in jeopardy almost any display of a similar kind, of which there are countless across the country. And what that court has said is that the display of the cross on public property is a excessive entanglement with religion. That's the technical phrase they use, and therefore that it violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which says that government, that this Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. So not only does this put in jeopardy what is happening with this particular monument, which, as you said, was put to honor World War I veterans more than 90 years ago, but it actually puts in jeopardy the many, many others that exist across the country.
Mm-hmm. Why was there no opposition in 1925 when this thing went up?
That's a good question. I think it shows a huge shift in fundamental ways of how we think about these things. That historically, we have said, you know, every government, every political community tries to figure out what justice is and tries to figure out who we are as a people in relation to justice. And historically, there's always been a place for God in that. There's always been a place for not just based on revealed religion, but that naturally we have some conception that justice comes from God, our rights come from God, and that who we are and how we should operate has some basis in who God is and how God made us. I think that's changed. I think that's changing in a fundamental and I think possibly very damaging way, where we don't have that in common, and I think that's part of why we don't have a conception of justice in common to the same degree we did in the past. So even though this seems in the small sense about crosses and displays for memorials, I think it involves a much larger cultural argument and the argument of who we are and how we understand what's good and just.
Mm-hmm. There was an article in the Baltimore paper over the weekend from a bishop who said, "We no longer live in Christendom." And he was sort of lamenting that he said in the salad days of the 1950s and 60s, the question in the neighborhood was, what church do you go to? And now you say, why do you go to church?
Yes, and I would say, I think that's, and I think that really does ask a fundamental question. On one hand, we are a country built on religious liberty that doesn't want to force people to believe anything. At the same time, we have lived in this tension, and I think it can be a very healthy tension, that who you believe, where you believe your rights come from, whether you believe other people are created in the image of God, says a lot about whether a political community will be held together by a correct view of justice and humanity. And I think it is true that a lot of that is being lost, and I think that a lot of our deep dysfunction can be traced to outliers of that larger conversation. Mm-hmm. So I think the bishop has a good point, and I think he's right to see that this is part of a larger issue. This is part of a bigger point.
Mm-hmm. Adam, when they use the words excessive entanglement, isn't that a little radical? Isn't that a little over the top?
Even they're willing to admit it to some degree if you read the opinion, where they acknowledge that in many ways, this would not be seen as excessive entanglement, given the how extensively even presidents who weren't particularly religious believed that things like this were perfectly reasonable and perfectly good and even healthy expressions of how we understand ourselves as human beings and as Americans. So I think it really is an attempt to you know, reconstitute a lot of our sources of what's good. And I think that is a pretty radical shift from the very documents we're still... It's very interesting that you're trying to base this on the Constitution that itself comes out of a very different view of how the world works and how, what we should consider important.
Mm-hmm. The Harvey Weinstein fallout continues, and I know we've got about a minute before we go to break, which is something that might be just the right amount of time to talk about this. But I know that there's been, you know, certain aspects of this sexual revolution that were really meant and designed to liberate women, but it's really kind of turned the opposite into creating an environment for predators more than anything.
Yeah, and not entirely disconnected from what we were just talking about, because in many ways our old social mores, I don't think you can say that they were all perfect and that men and women had perfect relationships before the sexual revolution, but I think what we're learning is that what was supposed to free people has in many ways freed preying on people. And that what old rules that maybe we saw as oppressive were maybe in some ways protective of how men and women interact with each other and protected people from being not just preyed upon but having power used against them. And I think that that's something that many people who celebrate the sexual revolution and think that Hollywood and college campuses are the most enlightened places in the world are they're not willing yet to rethink their fundamental ideas, but they're very much looking at, but I think they're very much seeing that the playing out of this is not working the way they thought it was supposed to.
Mm-hmm. Adam, let me take a break. It is 15 minutes until the top of the hour when I return with Dr. Adam Carrington. We're going to talk a little bit about tax reform. Be back in a minute. Good morning. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. I have on our studio line Dr. Adam Carrington, professor from Hillsdale College. Adam, where are we with tax reform right now?
Well, it's not dead yet, which is ahead of both the health care bill and the man from Monty Python. But it at
That's
the same
hilarious.
Time it, at
this
the
is
same
why you
time,
can't
think,
leave me.
Exactly. Well, that's the one joke my students still get that's older than 2005. So it passed a hurdle in the Senate. It got through as part of a larger budget measure. So we're still a long way from it, but it does seem to have the possibility of getting through. And I think there are some useful and helpful parts of it, particularly the family tax credit that Marco Rubio and Mike Lee were able to get into the bill when there was some debate as to whether they would be able to.
Explain what that tax credit is.
It is a credit for if you have a child under the age of 17, you can deduct what you owe in taxes up to a certain amount, and they're pushing for, I think, $2,500. So if you have a tax bill of $2,500 and you have a child of that age, then that entire tax bill is wiped out. And I think a particularly good thing they're doing with it is they're attaching it not just to the income tax, which not everyone pays, but also to the payroll tax, what you pay on Social Security and Medicare, which I think will also help some families that are in the working class, lower middle class section of the economic bracket, which they particularly, I think, are, you know, struggling to make ends meet. So I think those are some good it's a good thing, I think, that hopefully stays in the plan if it gets through.
Adam, what percentage of Americans really don't pay any taxes, with the exception of sales tax and things like that?
Actually, just about everyone who has a steady income pays some kind of tax, if you include the payroll taxes, Medicare, Social Security. So if the tax credit applies to both income and payroll, then almost everyone would benefit from this. It's the income tax. Close to, I believe it's near half the country now doesn't pay income taxes in, mm-hmm. in a given year. So that's where who this applies to or what taxes it applies to can make a big difference. And I think this is an interesting point about priorities. We spend a lot of time encouraging economic growth and jobs and saying our tax system should do so. The question is, do we also encourage and support families? And should we also encourage and support families and say those are things we want to invest in? That parents are doing a public good in making and raising children. And I think that is something that we need to ask ourselves, and that I think a good, healthy polity is going to encourage in addition to jobs and economic growth.
Now, did I hear correctly that the new tax plan might add another category for the richest people out there, which could include a tax cut for them?
Yes. And this is where I think we do have to ask what our priorities are. There are some parts of the Republican Party that really are driving only income tax rate cuts, and that's the one thing they want to focus on. And I think that mindset, I'm not saying that those aren't necessarily beneficial, but they're also, I think, stuck a little bit in the early 1980s mindset when tax rates were 30% higher than they are now, if not more than 30% in some cases. And I think that, again, the question needs to be, where are people hurting most? Where are the greatest injustices or unfairnesses in the tax bracket? And I think that if you're going to have to choose, I think it's probably best, can you balance it? Can you have a little bit of both family tax relief and these rate tax reliefs? But if you're going to have to choose, you have to say who's hurting more, working families or those in the highest income tax brackets.
Mm-hmm. Adam, let's talk a little bit about we got on the subject of priorities. And I'm curious as to President Trump's really his core support group and then really how the rest of Washington might differ from them. Is there a difference that you see?
Yes, and I think that I didn't come up with this. Eliana Johnson from wrote in Politico, I think, a good article pointing this out, that a lot of people in Washington see the priority should be legislation, tax reform, health care reform, immigration reform, and they see a lot of what President Trump is doing in the thing he's been most focused and disciplined on have been things like saying Merry Christmas, having getting players in the NFL to respect the national anthem by standing for it, and they see that as distractions. Well, if you look at a lot of his core supporters, they believe that a much larger cultural war is going on, one that they might see the cross issue that we talked about at the beginning related to. And they see that as something to focus on. They don't see it as a distraction. And I think that this brings in a lot of a question of what do we want a president to do? To what degree do we want him to be a chief executive that executes laws, that suggests legislation to Congress? And to what degree is he also a cultural leader of at least part of the country? And I think that in many ways, presidents have tried to be both. And in many ways, I think President Trump sees himself even more as the cultural leader of a section of the country.
Mm-hmm. There was a fundraiser over the weekend where five presidents assembled for it. And I have to say, to see all five presidents in a row was kind of fun, fun picture, fun photograph. And I was saying earlier in the show, I got to give that president, Jimmy Carter, a lot of credit. He looks amazing at 93, doesn't he?
He does. The idea that he has been able to be this involved in public policy, regardless of what you think of his opinions since then, is quite a testament to his resilience. Because as you can see with every president, President Obama, President George W. Bush, and I think even President Trump, that job takes a lot out of you. And I know we can be very critical of presidents, but wow, is it a heavy burden for whoever operates or whoever occupies that office.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to say I hope I looked that good at 93, but I don't look that good now.
I think I might look. I think you might have to dig to find how good I look at 93.
Well, Adam, thanks so much for being on the show. I just love having you as my guest and being a regular. So thank you again and again.
Always a pleasure. Glad to be on whenever you'll have me.
Thanks, Adam. It's 5 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break, and we've got a great second hour coming up as well. Dr. Chris Thurman is going to be with us, and Dr. David Aikman. So we've got a great second hour coming up. We'll be back in just a minute. Good morning. Happy Monday. I think I can say happy Monday. It is happy Monday. I hope you're starting your week well. Hope you got some rest over the weekend. Got some projects done, if that was your goal. We've got an interesting second hour coming up. Dr. Chris Thurman, he's a psychologist and an author. He has written a book called The Lies We Believe About God, Knowing God for Who He Really Is. I think that's going to be a very fascinating conversation. He has outlined these lies, and I guess we have, from time to time, believed some of them. And we need to be aware of what has maybe crept in that is not true, that we need to always be getting ourselves best informed as to who God is and who we are. And I think Dr. Chris Thurman is going to be helping us with that. He'll come on about 8 minutes after the hour. If you're planning your day accordingly and you're jumping into the shower right now, you've got, about 10 minutes to get through the shower and get a robe on at least. And then we'll talk to Chris Thurman. And then Dr. David Aikman, our foreign affairs correspondent, he's the best. We're going to talk to him in the second hour as well. So we'll take a break, and then I'll be back with more of the Early Morning Late Show in just a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.